Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening. September 7th, 2006, and a tremendous amount of material to cover tonight. In just about every ancient text that you look in, one theme seems to be recurring, and that is that a glass of fresh water is probably the most precious thing you could find on the face of the earth, especially in the many dire times we read about that the ancients had to go through. So that's why I personally believe and have placed in front of you the ability to get the best water filter around. I use my Berkey water filter every day in my house to filter water, whether it comes from the tap or if I'm on a camping trip using rainwater or stream water. And I also take it on my world travels with me. That and my little radio. These are things that I use, and I believe that you will want to use these also. First, and in the spirit of keeping the information short regarding the 800 number, etc., once again, the Berkey water filter 800 number offer for people who want to use credit cards over the phone, 800-983-5622, and with that 800 number, there are two offers, the Berkey water filter with four black Berkey filters, and also you get the free shortwave radio due to supply. I've changed the radio type to a Kato brand WRX-911 radio, and excellent shortwave radio, and so that is available with the Berkey offer. Free shipping to the 50 states. Once again, 800-983-5622. Also, all of this available on my webpage, jmccsci.com. That's the abbreviated form of my webpage, jmccsci.com. And, of course, www in front of that. And then also for mail order folks, the mail order address, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. Once again, that's $315 for the Berkey water filter. That's the big Berkey stainless steel with four filters. That's the two that come with the unit plus two extras that you will need in an emergency, and the free Kato WRX-911 shortwave emergency radio. That also, with the book order, there's the three books for people who want to get started reading about my material. The three books, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes, the Atlantis to Tesla, Colburn Connection book, the weather book, and the 60-page pamphlet, plus the two videos, 2003 UFO Congress lecture on Planet X, and the 2004 video lecture, my presentation at the International UFO Congress regarding electric highways to the stars. And so at any rate, that also including the free shortwave radio, also, and that was $109. The price of that has gone up this week because the initial offer, $89, we just couldn't hold it down at that price. That was almost a giveaway. But still a very good price at $109 for that set of books and videos plus the free radio. Also, just want to mention there's a new offer on the web page, the secure web ordering page. Anybody that orders over $100 worth of books, videos, etc., will get that free Kato radio also. On to the show. A tremendous amount of hype this week on storm activity. I'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about the ploy of schools to have a medical emergency waiver signed by parents that would potentially allow them to have your kids vaccinated on a field trip. Isn't that interesting? Some very sketchy language. I'll get into that. And then the main topic, the science topic, talking about how electricity works in outer space. Something very subtle in how it works around solid bodies like planets and small asteroids and dust, etc., in outer space. Something that your mainline science people have no clue about, nor do they know how to measure it. So, at any rate, all of this coming up on this show. First, a couple quick announcements. And turns out that the CEOs of defense corporations are making nearly 16 times the salary, or the raises, I should say, are 16 times those of CEOs of non-defense company corporation CEOs. This study was done recently, released August 30th. Two groups who show that the chief executives, CEOs, that is, of defense corporations, doubled their salaries over the past 4 years, or 5 years, actually, since September 11th, 2001, whereas the average CEO increase in pay only went up 6%. So doubling their salary, that's a 100% increase versus a 6% increase. That's 16 times as much money for our good war buddies, the guys in the war industry. Big money, big profits, and that's why you will not see an end to the so-called terrorist, the strain to have terrorists and new terrorists and all kinds of terror activity and people being used and abused like the people, well, I just don't have to go into that. Many other talk show hosts talk about that. But that little fact possibly slipping through the cracks. Also in from many sources, reference to a study that just came in, also August 27th, that Thera, the giant volcanic eruption that occurred in the Bronze Age of ancient Greece, was this was about 3,600 years ago, around the time that Venus was roaming through the solar system. A lot of people refer to this time as the time when Planet X was here, but it simply could not have been. The estimate that I make for probably the big guy coming through was probably around 4,200 years ago. There's an unfortunate mixing of dates here and a confusion between what Venus, the comet, eventually to become the planet Venus, or Quetzalcoatl as the Mayans called it, which did have its devastating effect on Earth, probably in the area of 3,600 years ago. But at any rate, Thera, the vast volcanic explosion in the Greek Isles, being probably 1.5 times larger than previously thought, with, of course, great tsunamis killing much of the population in that area. And, of course, Pompeii, the city of Pompeii, being buried, as were probably many other locations. Of course, the studies that were reported do not talk about the possibility of extra solar system objects coming through causing these events, but I want to also mention that there's a lot of internet chatter about this being due to Planet X, and it's clearly not the case. Obviously, as I said, Planet X coming at least 600 years earlier. And here's the scenario. Let me quick make a case for this. About 4,200 years ago, Hale-Bopp and the original seed that became the comet and then planet Venus came into the solar system with an entourage attached to something that is it's one of the best scenarios I have personally for an object called Planet X, Nibiru, Wormwood, or whatever. And so the two objects that were trailing and left behind were, one was Hale-Bopp, which was pulled away by members of our solar system and brought into a sun-independent orbit around our sun, and also Venus, which came in the plane of the planets. So the difference there was that Venus then started encountering the planets. It was captured by Jupiter, probably wandered through our solar system as a large comet for a period of about 600 years, being the main deity of the people that lived prior to the great catastrophe. around 3,600 years ago, the best estimate is that this is when the Great Flood, which was water from above, not a flood or a tsunami-type flood or a dam breaking, natural dam breaking and causing flooding of an area. This was a worldwide conflagration flood, of which the Noah story and the Moses story, all of those occurring at that time. And by the way, there were two major events 54 years apart. We know that from the Mayan calendar. And this idea that the Mayan calendar somehow predicts 2012 as being a year of devastation is pure garbage. There is no such implication in the Mayan history or chronology. And what, in fact, the Mayans had many dates that they believed could be damaging to Earth, all due to celestial events. The biggest one being Venus, and since Venus is now tucked into its nice little orbit between us and the Sun, it does not pose a future problem for Earth. So, but the Mayan calendar still tracks, as it's one of its main cyclical members, the planet Venus. Interesting, as do calendars from other countries around the world. So at any rate, spending a little too much time on that story, but just wanted to clarify that, because you may see some kind of mindless hype on that, that somehow that was due to Planet X. It could not be the case, but the original cause of this was a big object coming into the solar system, many big comets being seen in those days way back then, as indicated by the Colburn. I'll be getting into the Colburn again in future episodes of this show, talking about the Colburn and the historical ramifications. Something has come about. I hear this chatter kind of from people who are not scientists. People apparently want to create hype. There are a lot of baseless claims by people already trying to claim that the next solar cycle will be a huge one. Well, there's really no scientific basis for predicting a future solar cycle being large based on the past one, just the same as there is no historical record or scientific basis for predicting that, say, the 2006 hurricane season would be large based on the fact that 2005 was a large one. First of all, 2005 saw a tremendous number of manipulated storms. Storms that were driven up by the laser satellite technique that I've talked about on this show before. But that in no way could imply that 2006 would be a bumper crop year. When I made my prediction for the 2006 years for hurricanes, I said basically there are no electrical alignments in the solar system. There's no major activity going on. We're in a solar minimum. And there's no predictable basis for a big hurricane season in 2006. Actually, 2005 had some alignments, and we saw some electrical alignments. These are not gravitational alignments. These are electrical. I talk about these in my weather book. But the point is, the 2006 season really had no cause to believe it would be a big hurricane season. And, of course, NOAA trying to hype this up because they get funding for it. And they're using, as I said before, storm terror, I call it, as a technique for securing more money, making them sound important. About a year and a half ago, NOAA was about to get cut funding. And so they came up with this ploy that the greenhouse effect is driving up hurricane activity. And this year they have egg all over their face. And I think it's rather comical, because they're basing their predictions on ridiculous theories that somehow warm water creates hurricanes, which is totally false. And then to expand on that and claim that the greenhouse effect, which is also a false theory, that somehow is creating more hurricane activity. Well, if those two theories were correct, the warm water hurricane theory and the greenhouse effect theory, then this year should have been a bumper crop for hurricanes, and it simply was not. It was a total dud. And just a quick comment on the Storm Florence. I got a kick out of Weather Service announcers who were, when they first saw this thunderstorm come off of Africa, they said, if it becomes a storm, we will call it Florence. It's just like, what was it, Ernesto, as it came out of Cuba, it was pretty much a thunderstorm at that point. And they said, if it had an eye, it would be here, with some guy pointing to a map on a TV station. So you're seeing them grabbing for straws, totally embarrassed, egg all over their face, because they built this up to be a vast hurricane season when it's a total dud. They also, about mid-course, corrected their prediction by reducing the number of alleged named storms and reducing the number of hurricanes that they were predicting, and they're still falling far short, as we are only on the letter F. And these storms were very questionable. Certainly Florence was named far earlier than it should have ever been named. It only had 30-mile-an-hour winds when they actually named it as a tropical storm. So absolutely ridiculous activity here, just groping. And now here's the way NOAA predicts storms. They take averages over the past. They take estimates based on a whole range of factors which have nothing to do with hurricane formation, and they then make some statistical projections. It would be like going to Las Vegas and saying, well, we're going to take all the statistics of the past 10 years in Las Vegas, and we're going to make a prediction that next year will be a certain type of year for bettors or winners or losers or the casinos, etc., at Las Vegas. That's exactly what they're doing with NOAA. When I make a prediction regarding hurricanes, I make it based on electrical alignments and the conditions that would spawn ionospheric activity and therefore increase levels of electrical energy in the Earth system that would then drive hurricanes. And I've been right on time and time again, including this summer when I said it would be a dud of a year. Last summer was a very difficult summer to predict because there were so many manipulated storms. When there are people introducing manipulation into the storm system, then how does one really predict in that situation? But back to the claims of people who are trying to say the next solar cycle is going to be a doozy, there is simply no scientific basis. In fact, it's hard to say. These predictions are very tenuous, and I tend not to make predictions unless they are scientifically verifiable and have enough factors weighting on the side of my prediction that I would have a high probability of being correct. But with the next solar cycle, let me give you an alternative possibility of what could happen, remembering that the current solar cycle that we're coming out of, the one that went through the 90s, the late 90s and into about 2005, that solar cycle was pumped up tremendously by a comet called Hale-Bopp. Hale-Bopp drummed up the solar energy for a period of about 6 years, discharging the solar capacitor on a daily basis, that energy from the solar capacitor being driven down into the solar surface where the fusion occurs, and driving up the solar maximum to the point where we went through the year 2000, which was supposed to be the solar maximum, and the condition of the sun kept going up and up and up through 2001, through 2002, into 2003, and the scientists then just threw up their hands and they said, we don't even know what's going on anymore. So anyway, the bottom line was that there were causes of this. The sun just doesn't do stuff on its own by itself for no reason. There are causes, and the causes and effects. They are electrical, and you have to understand the true theories of what causes the sun and the solar system to respond. Interestingly enough, the solar cycle goes as the orbit of Jupiter, and there's also apparently a throbbing of this solar capacitor, which apparently is on an 11-year cycle also, based also on the fact that Jupiter is a very large comet discharging the solar capacitor. And so all of these factors factor in. Also, when Jupiter passes through the region I call the August return current sheet, that's the region of space where Earth is in the month of August, remember that Jupiter only goes through that region once every 11 years. So at any rate, Jupiter electrically coupled with the Sun, also with the solar capacitor, which is probably 2 to 3 times out beyond the orbit of Pluto, the very farthest, Pluto, not being called a planet anymore, excuse me for laughing, but whatever Pluto is, I call it a planet, whatever, beyond Pluto. We still call it Pluto, I guess. And so anyway, the what I'm trying to get at here is that the next solar cycle, because the Sun was so pumped up, sometimes the Sun oscillates. It goes into oscillations. And the next solar cycle could possibly actually go into a more of a minimal solar activity state as a response to being so far so heavily pumped up over the last cycle. It's very difficult to say if we see new activity in the solar system, such as, say, some of the big planets, I call them a star. Jupiter is really a small star, but say Jupiter or Saturn came into alignment in the August return current sheet, there could be an incredible pumping up of the Sun. So it depends on conditions like this. It also depends on whether we have new large comets in the solar system. And once that solar capacitor becomes drained, the Sun has to build it up again. So some of these cycles and conditions can alternate. And in fact, through the Middle Ages, we saw epochs where the Sun's energy actually was reduced by a considerable amount, and we had many ice ages where there was a considerable amount of failed crops and because of the cold. And now imagine, even with water, pumping water from underground with our tremendous agricultural system, if things became cold and the growing season shortened, we could see failures in the crops throughout North America and the other big breadbaskets of the world, and vast starvation, because the world grain supply, which at one time we had stored up for up to 7 years, of course, Billy Clinton gave that all away, allowed the people to sell it all over the world for big profits, and we have no food stored up. My understanding is we have about less than a week's food stored up in this country. So anyway, those who are claiming that the next solar cycle will be a huge one, typically baseless claims, and we'll have to see. I'm not making any personal predictions at this time. I'm just saying there are many factors that could bring it into actually a very minimal solar cycle. We'll have to wait and see and do more analysis as time goes on. Just a brief comment on the deplorable state of American universities, especially the graduate schools of the American universities, and why Americans cannot get into them. Now, when I was in my college years, everybody knows when that was. It was in the 60s. In graduating and applying to graduate schools, the bulk of students in graduate schools were Americans, native-born. And there were a few foreign students in there. But through the next decade, that changed dramatically. And you only then saw foreign students coming into the graduate schools, especially in the sciences, chemistry, physics, biology, on and on, astronomy, etc. And where this, I believe in diversity too, but I also believe that when we are funding these institutions, that they should be dedicated first to the students here that come out of this country, and then, of course, we do need a mixing and diversity and an exchange with foreign countries. But now it is to the point where you can hardly find an American student in an American university graduate school. And these students don't stay here. They go back to their countries and use those technologies, which is good. However, then we end up with situations where the political flavor, for example, has now turned against Iran, which I personally think this is a political ploy based on the monetary situation of this country. But be that as it may, guess who educated all the nuclear scientists that now live in these countries? We have basically given away all of our best technology, just as we've given away our manufacturing and other industries to foreign countries, leaving the United States gutted. And, of course, this was an intentional, a very intentional ploy by the people who need to take the United States down. There's a very simple rule. It's known wide and far and wide throughout the security agencies and the think tanks, anybody that knows anything about the United States and the alleged, or the not alleged, but the planned New World Order, as they were, are called. They cannot go to a one-world government with a very powerful, strong nation like the United States in place. They have to take it down and bring us down to the level of all the other countries before they can take charge, because they know that a strong nation amongst the hundreds of nations they want to rule, a strong nation would rise up and squash them like a cockroach on a dirty counter. And that's exactly what would happen. So they have to bring this country down step by step, and that is one of the ploys. Next thing I want to talk about is I happened to get a hold of some of the signing documents that parents have to sign as their kids go to public schools. And one of them basically states the following. In case of a medical emergency, the school representative, and they also mentioned that this would be on a field trip specifically, which makes it very bizarre. So those three things in the very first sentence, that in case of a medical emergency, while on a field trip, a school representative. Now, who would the school representative be? Why not a school employee or a, you know, that representative word kind of strikes me as odd. Or why only on a field trip? And the broad interpretation of the word medical emergency could include, in my way of thinking, something like, oh, there's a possibility that students could get bird flu, so we have to inject them with some kind of antivirus. And by the way, there's a chip in there. So it's obvious that this is a carefully worded medical release they're asking parents to sign. And this is in addition to the general release to allow kids to go to the school nurse, get non-prescription like Tylenol or aspirin or whatever they give kids these days if they're sick or if they have a headache or whatever. This is a second waiver, very clearly. It should be responded to, because certainly parents want their kids to be protected in case of an emergency. But the problem is it opens the door, so I would imagine that parents would write an addendum to this stating that this does not include preventative or perceived threats, and certainly no chips allowed. So anyway, this is a potential problem, and it just appears that the schools are a place where ongoing infiltration of personal rights could be a very huge problem in the future. I just want to, if people think this is a little crazy, there was a school up in Oregon that had their entire student population injected with chips. And the initial thought was, gee, isn't this wonderful? And then apparently the backlash came back that it was amazing that this somehow got through. But the point is that people are now aware of this, the effort to try and put chips in everything from chickens to kids to adults. And, of course, this being used already in many places. I did a little bit here, a little story a couple weeks ago about electronic passports being issued and the fact that these could be read up to 60 feet away by readers that a person could carry around and literally read all the passports of somebody standing in a line waiting for an airplane or in a hotel, or you wouldn't even have to be in the person's room. You could be two rooms away and read their passport electronically with a properly devised reading device. So these kind of problems emerging for the public. On to the main science topic for the night. I'm going to talk about the way electricity works in outer space. And there are two very incorrect sources of information floating around that you may have had access to. One is the scientific journals and the American Geophysical Union meetings, where they're trying to introduce these topics, but in a very standard manner. In other words, they're trying to keep the dirty snowball comet model, the Big Bang, the gravity-only solar system, the fusion at the core of the sun model, and all of these very incorrect concepts. They want to keep those, but somehow introduce the fact that they're measuring electric fields out there. Well, they're measuring the electric fields, obviously, but the problem is, they don't know where they come from. They don't know. They're trying to relate it to magnetic fields, which is a secondary effect. You need electrical currents to create magnetic fields, and herein lies the downfall of traditional space theory or astrophysics theory, because they don't understand there has to be a source of power out there creating these electric fields like a battery. And just like any battery, they don't last forever. In fact, in outer space, batteries last a very short time unless there's an ongoing source of power that drives that battery and keeps it going. So those are some of the principles I discovered in my theoretical work decades ago, and I'm trying to impart this to the public. So you need a source of power. There's also some internet hoaxsters, wannabes, and charlatans out there trying to claim that somehow electrical currents just flow around the solar system and the galaxy and intergalactic space, and that these just flow around willy-nilly at their own will, and they've been doing it forever, but they have no idea what causes these electrical currents. So that's the second misnomer, that currents somehow just by themselves form out there. So that's why in my theoretical work, in my papers, in my books, I take the everybody that reads these or on my radio show, I take people from the very core source of the center of power, and that's the fusion in the upper atmosphere of the sun, or it could be in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, which is a small star, or the upper atmosphere of Saturn, which is also a small star-like object with ongoing fusion. It doesn't light up like a star, but it has a tremendous amount of heat output, literally three times the amount of energy that reaches it from the sun, comes off of Saturn. So Saturn is generating its own heat. And what's comical is every time you see this new data, these new realizations come in from spacecraft, as I did when I was at Cornell watching the data from the Voyager spacecraft come in, scientists, and I sat in the room with these same scientists, and they would go, well, it must be due to the latent heat, the original heat of formation of Saturn, and it's just now being given off. And somebody would go, yeah, that sounds good, and so they'd write it down and publish it in a journal magazine, and those ideas would stick. I call it hip pocket. There's a term, hip pocket surveyor. It's a guy that really doesn't know what he's doing, goes out in the middle of the wood, pulls out his compass, walks along a line, and claims that he's just surveyed some land. And anybody who's a surveyor knows that there are rules of surveying, there are instruments and techniques that you use in surveying, and you have to follow these, and you have to go back to the original lines and surveys and know how to read those and interpret them. And so there's a term, hip pocket surveyor. It's this guy that goes out, flips out his compass, and walks down through the woods and claims he's surveyed some property. Well, the same thing is true of space scientists. They're sitting in a meeting, new data is coming in, somebody flips out of his back pocket an idea, and somehow that sticks, it goes into the journals, and 30 years later you're sitting there with the same complete garbage, and nobody realizes that's where that idea came from. I call it hip pocket science. Just throwing an idea out, throwing some mud against a wall, it sticks. But at any rate, the point is that I want to take people through the basic electrical setup in the solar system and show you how it works, and then ultimately how that energy gets down to our upper atmosphere, the ionosphere, and then down to us to drive our weather. How does it get into a comet to cause a comet to act as it does? And so these are some basic ideas, and in this set of concepts, there's something very subtle that happens. For example, here's one of the subtleties that not many people understand, and certainly not either the professional scientists or the internet hoaxsters that are trying to, it's kind of comical to see the way they say something. They go, oh, this looks like it could be electrical, so it's explained by some term that they use. It's just almost comical. I call it talking science trash. But anyway, what I want to do is be very specific about how these work. Let's take an object, the size of a baseball, some little rock that's on outer space floating around, and it's the size of a baseball. The electrical capacitor is around it, it's moving through the capacitor, and it starts to discharge that capacitor. And I like to use the example of the backyard bug killer. When an object flies, or a bug flies into the capacitor in that backyard bug killer, it discharges that capacitor briefly, zapping the bug. And everybody's heard that little zzz sound when the bug gets kind of french fried and drops into the bottom container. Well, the solar system is very much like that. The solar capacitor is very much like that, only we don't have metal grids. We have nebular clouds that form the outside rim of the capacitor. So the end result is that any rock, any planet, any comet object, any hard object out there, a piece of dust, will do the same thing. We'll discharge the solar capacitor locally. And the end result is that there is an electrical charge that builds up on this rock or object. So I'm talking about something about the size of a baseball, a rock out there. And this is the point I'm trying to get at. The charge forms around the surface of the object. And there's a certain charge density that can form around that object. The more charge you get on the object, the more it's going to resist charge building up on the object. And this charge, if you just all of a sudden could unplug it from the solar system and turn off the solar capacitor, which is driving this process, all of a sudden atoms and ions from around the region would come and neutralize that charge so quickly it would be in the blink of an eye. So you need this process to be ongoing. You need the source of power and electricity to be ongoing. And that is the key to understanding how the solar system works. These currents don't just flow around on their own willy-nilly because they like to. Everything going on in outer space has a cause and it has an effect. There's a source of power, and there's something driving these systems. It's not magical. So the baseball-sized object has a certain amount of surface relative to its volume. And anybody that knows basic mathematics, surface area goes as the square of the radius. And the volume goes as the cube of the radius. So as you go to bigger and bigger objects, say you go up to something twice the size of your original baseball-sized rock, the radius increases by a factor of 2. The surface area, therefore, would increase by a factor of 4, and the volume would increase by a factor of 8. So what appears to be an object that's just twice as big as the one over here, so your baseball then expands to the size of, say, a softball, it's about twice as big. Physically, it looks twice as big. It has 4 times as much surface area, but 8 times as much volume. Okay, let's triple that radius of our baseball-sized objects. Now we've got something that's about the size of a basketball. It's got 3 times the radius, of the original baseball. It has 9 times the surface area, but 27 times the volume. You see what's happening here. As you go to larger and larger objects, the volume increases as the cube, and so it gets larger much faster. The surface area of the object doesn't increase that much, so your the area where the charge is stored, that is on the surface of the object, becomes less and less relative to the volume until you get up to something the size of the Earth. So the storage capacity, the storage capacitance, or the ability to store charge on the surface of something the size of the Earth is far less than something the size of a baseball. Now go the other direction and start going down to smaller and smaller objects. The surface area of a small object is far greater relative to its volume than the baseball. Say you get all the way down to a dust particle, it has probably millions of times more charge holding capability than the baseball. And herein lies the crux of the issue regarding solar system activity, that only objects that are small are really affected by electrical activity in outer space. So you have guys like Carl Sagan, who once stated, then other people have repeated this, that if you had objects in the solar system that were charged, they would go flying off at the speed of light, and that would contradict this and prove that there could be no electricity in outer space. Well, guys like Sagan, most astronomers, there's a myth that astronomers somehow have a good background in physics. They simply don't. My training is in physics, and so when I look at space science data, I analyze it in terms of physical principles that I understand. Astronomers and most space scientists, and in fact most astrophysicists, do not have what I would call a good background in classical physics. And so these little subtleties bypass them, and they make up ridiculous statements and then follow those statements to incorrect conclusions, and the basis of their science is also incorrect. So just a little concept like charge to mass ratio or charge surface area to volume of an object in outer space, these concepts are totally misunderstood both by standard science and by the imposters that run around the internet claiming to be scientists when they're not. That's why, for example, when I talk about comets, the plasma discharge comet model, there are hundreds of subtle concepts that go into that model that are not exactly obvious to the average person. Let me give another example of a type of subtle characteristic of electrical discharges in outer space that surpass what standard scientists imagined could happen. Now, back again, if you had a charged object in outer space, and I've gone through all of these calculations myself, and I've heard standard scientists say, oh, well, if you know, this is the reason you cannot have charged objects in outer space. So I'll go through this so you out there, the general public, understand how they have a flawed argument, how they have flawed thinking, and how this leads to their belief that space cannot have electrical charges or currents, etc. Although they measure them all the time, which is funny and contradictory, of course, but don't tell them that. Let's talk about what's called a space charge sheath. That is an area around a charged object that will form very quickly. Let's go back to our baseball-sized object again, object in outer space, and let's say for whatever reason it becomes charged. There's electrical charge on its surface, typically electrons, negatively charged on the surface of this baseball-sized object. And you put it out in the plasma environment of outer space, all of a sudden every positive ion for 100 miles around would come moving over to it and start to basically neutralize it. And this would happen very quickly in outer space because there's no resistance, there's nothing to stop all the ions and other positively charged particles from coming over and neutralizing that object. And so the question is, how could you have an object like, say, a comet nucleus, which maintains a net negative charge over the course of days, months, weeks, etc.? It seems like a physical contradiction. But there again, you have to look at the overall picture, where the sun is producing an electrical current that goes out in a continual manner from the surface of the sun, positive excess current off in the solar wind that comes out of the sun. It's like a wind of charged particles, and it has an excess of positive charge. This is a byproduct of the fusion process, and that's what supports the solar capacitor, which I said before, this big nebular ball capacitor out about 2 to 3 times the distance to Pluto, where this shell of charged particles sits out there. And that is a positively charged region of outer space around the sun. And this occurs, we've seen these around hundreds, if not thousands, of other stars. I have examples, pictures of these in my Planets, Comets, and Earth Changes book, and other drawings in other papers that I've published, etc. But basically, it's a big battery with the sun in the center, negatively charged, and the solar capacitor out there constantly being pumped up. Now, you've probably noticed on my webpage, which, by the way, is jmccsci.com, jmccsci.com. That's the abbreviated version. I constantly talk about the discharge of the solar capacitor. And also, there are return current sheets, one of them in the region of August, where Earth passes through in the month of August in our annual orbit around the sun. Now, these currents are moving all the time. One thing I also continually state is that a solar flare coming off the sun may not directly hit us, and you constantly hear standard scientists with PhDs saying, well, that solar flare missed us, so we're safe. Nothing happened. There's no effect on Earth. That's a completely 100% incorrect statement, because every solar flare that leaves the sun is pumping up and building up the solar capacitor, providing more energy to the outer solar system. And whenever the Earth or Jupiter or a comet or that little baseball-sized rock, whenever they discharge the solar capacitor, that energy moves back and returns to the sun. It's like a cycle. And that, in turn, builds up the fusion burning, the electrical burning of hydrogen in the sun, which is the source of power for our solar system. It's like having a furnace in the middle of the solar system, but an electrical furnace. And so there are two effects: the heat that comes off the sun in the way of light, visible light, X-rays, ultraviolet light, infrared heat that comes off the sun, all of this energy coming off the sun, but also in the form of an excess current of protons, which builds up that solar capacitor. And I've estimated that there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of times more units of energy coming off the sun in the form of electrical energy than there is in the form of light. Now, that's a lot of energy. But here's another subtlety, and of course, standard science misses this, that as Earth moves around in its circular orbit around the sun, it's involved in a very relatively steady state discharge of the solar capacitor. When we move through that August return current sheet, you can actually see in the satellites that are orbiting Earth, monitoring the winds, the charged particle counts, etc., you can actually see that the solar wind will die down to nothing or almost zero at times. And that's when you know you're in that August return current sheet. And it also can be a very volatile time, because that's when change occurs. And it's during these periods of change when the greatest electrical storm activity occurs in our upper atmosphere, and that drives directly our weather systems down on the surface of the Earth. So let's say that a flare goes out from the sun, totally misses us, builds up the solar capacitor, and causes Earth to discharge at a greater rate than it was before. That change could be enough to spark hurricanes, tornadic activity down on the surface of the Earth. And here's how it works. By building up the charge level in the ionosphere, all of a sudden that could expand or in some cases actually contract based on pressure systems in our atmosphere and lead to electrical discharges that go down and tap into thunderstorm heads, clouds that lift up and like a finger point upwards from the troposphere. The troposphere is the system of weather, the region of weather activity that we see, the clouds, etc., that we call our weather system, are typically in the very lower atmosphere called the troposphere. When these storm clouds build up, that's another very basic principle, is that you would not even see storm clouds if it weren't for the vertical electric field in our atmosphere. We would have very bland weather and clouds would not even form. The electrical conditions in our atmosphere are essential to cloud formation itself. But as these clouds build up, they then start to connect electrically. The highest clouds will connect electrically to the ionosphere and currents start to flow. That's where lightning comes from. We see lightning above storms. We see lightning in storms, in storm clouds, and we see lightning coming all the way down to the ground through these cloud systems, all stemming up to the ionosphere, which is built up by the electrical conditions in the solar system, which are passing by us all the time. So science, in its kind of blind approach that space is electrically neutral, is totally ignoring the entire basis of the most powerful energy source in the solar system, the electrical battery and capacitor of the sun. Now, if that capacitor were not there, we would not have electrical energy at Earth. We wouldn't have electrical energy in the comets. And the planets that are acquiring matter like Uranus, Neptune, Mars, we know, is increasing its atmosphere on a regular, ongoing basis. None of these processes would work at all. We would have very sterile environments. In fact, life on Earth as we know it would not exist, because our shielded magnetic field, which blocks the solar wind, that tremendous outpouring of wind that comes out of the sun, is actually blocked and buffered by our big magnetic field shield. That shield is not due to some internal magnetic field of Earth, but is due to many layers of magnetic field that go out from our upper atmosphere into outer space. These are plasma magnetic fields, and they change and whip around on a constant basis. They're also subject to the lunar cycles. When the moon comes between us and the sun, then the moon is literally blocking that solar wind from coming in and hitting Earth. Now, the moon, as it comes between us and the sun, that's what we call the new moon. And about 2 days later, after the new moon, as the moon moves out of the way and that solar wind starts to reconnect with our magnetic field that extends about 25,000 miles out into space from Earth, the moon is a quarter million miles, about 10 times farther away than the distance to the end of our magnetic field in that sunward direction. So when the moon moves out of the way, I call it the new moon passing. 2 days, a day and a half to 2 days after the new moon, that's when, boom, the solar wind comes pounding in, and that can trigger solar storm activity on Earth, which then can trigger storms. That's one of the factors, one of dozens of factors that I use when I do my weather prediction. What was 2 years ago, we had the August 27th mega storm set up, where in May of that year I predicted that August 27th, 2 years ago, there would be vast storms around the Earth. And up to that date, up to that date, even up to August 26th, there were hardly any storms at all around Earth. About midnight between August 26th and 27th, all you-know-what broke loose, and as the new moon passed. And that was one of the triggers that took Earth. We had over 60 major tropical storms develop in a couple hours. Now let me go through the alignments that we had. We had planetary electrical alignments. We had Mars at its closest approach to Earth in, a very long time, tens of thousands of years. And by the way, if you got an email this year stating that Mars would be its closest in a very long time and to go out and look for it, it was all garbage. Somebody, some hoaxer, was sending that around the internet. That was 2 years ago, August 27th. But at any rate, back to the story. In August 27th of 2 years ago, we had that close alignment on our backside with Mars. We had a new moon passing. We were in the August return current sheet, and we had other planets in very close alignment, electrical alignments with Earth. And we also had a bit of cometary activity in the solar system that was pumping up the sun to exaggerated levels. So all of these factors I could see coming around in I made the prediction in May of that year. It was very clear, and as I said before, I don't make predictions unless I have a good deal of sound scientific evidence to back up my statement. And I recall as the laughs and the hoots and the hollers around August 26th were filling the internet, and how they were silenced completely when around, like I said, midnight August 26th into the 27th, the Earth literally exploded into tropical storms. And there was an amazing event to watch from a weather standpoint. But what's bizarre is that nobody at the National Weather Service, the computer models, none of these people had a clue of what was going on. And that is standard fare. So, and I know that's why a lot of people listen to this radio show, is to start to get an idea of how these weather systems work, because that's what directly affects us. There are also some medical topics which I haven't had time to get into. For example, Parkinson's disease patients or victims often find relief around sunset. They call it sunset syndrome, and they actually get better for a little while, and I'm trying to work with the medical profession to actually reproduce this effect electrically and to bring relief to those people. So a lot going on in this solar system. We are definitely electrically connected to it. There's no question that the solar system is an entire electrical system. Our galaxy is the same. And one has to understand these basic principles to understand how much we are connected. There is a bit of basis for astrology, although I don't quite agree with all the predictions of astrology or predicting your future, but we are nonetheless very connected to our solar system. So at any rate, I hope this gives you an idea, a feeling for how the solar system works, how electrical discharges work, how electrons and protons and positively charged particles, atoms, molecules, etc., react around charged objects in outer space, and how this works, and why the standard theories that you would read in a college textbook or read about in the newspaper or in magazines like Science, etc., are totally incorrect. Once again, I'm out of time. This is Jim McKenney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.